Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. Thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are plenty more conversations about things you're interested in and things you don't know you're interested in yet. Not until you try them anyway. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or to iTunes, where you can get lots more for free.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. We're going to do something a bit different today on Conversations. You're going to hear a collection of stories today from different people. And we're calling it The Long Walk. Stories of going a long way from here to there on foot. Today you'll hear the story of one woman's walk across the Sahara Desert, literally to Timbuktu. There's a diplomat's pilgrimage, where he walked from the bottom of Spain all the way to the top. And there's the strange, freaked-out journey of a musician who walked barefoot across a vast distance over the red, baking hot surface of the Kimberley in WA. All these people took the long walk to break out of their humdrum lives, or because they were just sick of feeling bitter and angry about something horrible they'd been through. And for most of them, it worked. The ugly feelings that they had just eventually kind of dissolved and their minds cleared as their feet got harder. Today's first story comes from Paula Constant, and the idea for her long walk came to her almost casually while she was sitting on a beach in WA.
I was sitting on Cable Beach having a glass of wine and watching the camels walk down Cable Beach, and my then husband and I had been discussing trekking through Africa or going with a vehicle, and then sitting on Cable Beach watching the camels walk past, I said to Gary, well, why don't we just walk with them?
Why walking, Paula?
There's something rhythmic about walking that I really do love. And you are very, very present when you walk. You can't run away from anything. You are simply where you are at any given time. And I think that there's something very real about that. And in that way, you're immersed in your landscape, you're immersed in culture, and you have nowhere to go, nowhere to get out of it. And you just have to deal with what the world throws at you. I think that's a wonderful thing.
So real adventure then comes from shutting off your options.
Yes. Yes, that's a very good point, actually. I think the more that you can wind a window up, put your air conditioning on and bury your head in a novel and cold water, the less you understand what it is to be in an environment.
Now, Paula and her husband decided to begin their walk in London. So they set out one day from Trafalgar Square on foot. They walked down to the English Channel, down through all of France, walked through all of Spain, and crossed over into North Africa, into Morocco. But by then, Paula had hatched a much more ambitious plan for herself, and it was this: to trek right across the Sahara Desert. Now, the Sahara is the world's largest hot desert. It's vast. It runs right across North Africa. And more than that, Paula said she wanted to do this walk like a traditional woman of the Sahara.
I wanted to learn Arabic. I wanted to understand custom and culture, I think that's the best way to put it, as in to become comfortable sitting in a nomad's tent, to become comfortable within the culture. I think that was my major goal. I have very romantic notions, but I did want to dress with respect to culture. So the customary dress of a Sahrawi woman is known as malefa, and it's a long swathe of material that essentially ties up like a sack over your shoulders, and then it goes in a series of wraps around your body. And that usually goes over a cotton shift, which goes over in turn cotton trousers. So it's several layers. There's days I just trip over the whole thing and fall face down in the dirt.
So your party set off, and this was you, two guides, and your husband, and three camels.
Four camels
at that stage, a big fun. What did that mean for you when you set up camp? What was your role then as a traditional Sahrawi woman?
Well, it took me a while to come to terms with the fact that, in effect, I was never going to be a traditional Sahrawi woman. I think that possibly took me about 2,000 km to work out, actually. But I was trying, twisting myself in knots, trying to be something that you really can't. Trying to make tea and prepare food the right way and always be in malefa and always greet people at my camp the right way. For any nomads that arrive, which they do daily, no matter where you camp in the Sahara, there will always be a turban pop up over the sand dune. But you can also lie down on a mattress and put your malefa over your head and go to sleep in the middle of camp when there's heaps of people around and nobody's going to be offended. It took me a long time to understand that.
Well, as you might imagine, there were hundreds of irritating little mishaps every day. And on top of that, Paula and her husband just weren't getting on.
Yeah, wheels were falling off. Yeah, it wasn't flash. We'd come a really long way. I think there's things wrong in marriages that you often don't acknowledge until, you know, things get tough. And there were things that have been wrong for a very long time. So I'll make that distinction. I think people often assume it's the walk that split us up. I don't think it's that simple. But certainly when we came down to Mohammed at the start of this walk, for the first time I did feel that Gary didn't really want to be there. Whether or not that's a correct assumption or mine, I will never know. Certainly that schism was widening day by day.
But despite all that, they pressed on into the desert. Paula had a vague idea that in the Sahara, in all that silence and space, she might find something she was longing for, something that she called the big empty. And soon enough, she found it.
The first night I ever called it that was when we did camp just near Chicago, and we had a beautiful camp up on some dunes, up on a flat part of dunes, and that's magic camp when you've got good feed for the camels and then you've got nice sand to lie on. It's absolutely heaven. The nomads actually say that the nights are your reward for enduring the day. And this is so true in the desert because it can be 40 degrees and then suddenly the sun drops and the sky is stunning, absolutely stunning. It's purple and pink. Everything's still. It smells beautiful. You can just hear your camels munching contentedly and all the stars come out. And it's a night sky that you can't begin to imagine unless you've seen it. It's crystalline and just amazing. And there's an utter silence. There's a silence so intense that you can hear your own heartbeat. And it feels genuinely as if there's nothing else there on the face of the planet, that you are completely alone. So in that sense, it was that I did live for the whole of my journey, and that was the big empty for me.
Well, not long after that, her husband decided that he'd had enough, and he left. That left Paula with just her guides and her camels. Then it was down to one guide, and that guide proved to be so incompetent that Paula had to fire him. So she pressed on into the desert alone.
And it all went horribly wrong. Yeah. I no sooner put the lead down than the brown camel stepped on his rope, got a fright, and tore his nose ring straight out of his nose. And at that point, he went kicking off into the sand dunes, carrying the bag that had my money and passport in it and quite a few other important bits of supplies. I put the other two camels down and unloaded them, and I grabbed the sort of GPS and compass and bottle of water and thought, well, I don't have a choice here. I've got to follow him. But what I was thinking was, to be pretty honest with you, after 5 minutes, I was thinking, look, I just hope he backs off that bag. If he backs off that bag, you know what? I actually don't care. Let the camel go. I've done $1,000, a couple of $1,000. And then I got indignant, I think, because he started to play with me. I would get close and he would run away, and I would get close and he would run away. And I'd weighted a rope and I was trying to get the rope over his neck. I was trying all sorts of different things. And then I really got indignant and I thought, no, you know, this is a point of pride now.
So you tracked this camel with your passport and money, what, through the night?
Yeah.
Through the night,
desert. Look, I got close enough to turn him back. And that took a while. The reason it took a while is because I was in dunes and I just couldn't find a way. Every time I'd try to head him off, I would actually lose him behind dunes. So it was, and my skills weren't good enough then either. So
how did you catch him in the end, Paula?
Look, it's something I still feel embarrassed about, particularly after I've spoken to a lot of Australian cameleers, because they just look at me and say, well, either that I don't believe you or that was really stupid. And it was something Mbaraka told me months before in the Western Sahara. I'd said, well, what would you do if you were in Australia and you wanted to catch one of the wild camels? I now know how they do it, but he's a nomad. And he said, well, you need two strong men. He went through a whole process with me. And he said, but you never try this on your own, Lala. It's very dangerous and you need two strong men. And
so tell me what you did. You followed the process.
Yeah, I did. look, in the end, I thought, I was so tired and I was so fed up. And I thought, look, this is my last chance. And if he kicks me in the head, I'll deal with it. So I basically snuck up behind him and launched myself at his tail. And what Mbaraka had said is, if you wrench a camel extremely hard by its tail, like wrench with your full body weight, it will topple him. Onto the side. And he said, at that point, the other man goes around and gets a rope around its nose and then into its mouth. Once you've got a rope around a camel's nose, you've fairly much got
control. So you grabbed him by the tail.
And then made a flying leap across him. And I had a slip knot around my wrist. And so as soon as I was laying down, basically across his stomach, and it happened so fast, it's still, I still get my heart going when I think about it. And anyway, I wound up with the rope over his nose and through his mouth, and then I got one around his neck, and I can still remember And then I just sort of fell down onto the ground because he's frantically scrambling. His back end was up by that stage, and he sort of, so I've rolled off and I'm on the ground, and I've got these two ropes in my hand, and I'm lying on the ground or squatted down on the ground, holding him about a meter from his nose, and he's got his nose down and he's snorting it, and we're both eyeballing each other, and I think, I gotcha.
You did something it takes two desert nomads to do.
Yes, but I don't think I would ever do it again.
Well, eventually Paula got a new super competent guide called Habus. And by then they were getting close to the city of Timbuktu, which is a real city, by the way. It sounds like a mythical Dr. Seuss town, but it is a real place.
I was continually asking my guides, which stars am I looking at? Which stars are leading me there? And Habus showed me one night. He said, see, there's two stars that come down from your left. There's two that point down and another one from your right that point down. They point down into a V. If you follow the confluence of those two lines of stars, you will find Timbuktu. And I reached Sanjin, and I knew, I'm looking at my map thinking it should be just here. I should be only like 4 kilometres from it. And we got up to the dune, and I couldn't see anything, and the light started to fade. And then I was facing back out where we'd come from, I had my back to the wind, and Ali said, see, if you look over there, there's Timbuktu. And I swing around, and there, sure enough, there's these lights. It's just the lights of a town. And I mean, I'd been out for 28 days, I think, on that stretch. It'd been a long time since I'd seen lights anyway. And then I looked at them and I looked up, and there, right between the two stars, exactly between the two lines of stars, the way Habus had described, sat Timbuktu. And to this day, I've never felt such a sense of triumph and achievement. I wondered how many people over the years have walked over that same set of dunes, and they must have gone up here and looked over there, and they'd finally made it.
By then, Paula had walked a truly vast distance from Morocco through Mauritania and Mali without ever being caught up in any serious personal danger. But now she was in a part of Africa which was caught up in civil wars. This was bandit territory.
I was with a particularly incompetent guide who had insisted that we take a route along a road. And again, it's very, very difficult to argue with them. A vehicle came towards us and they had guns mounted. And they were all obviously coked up or drugged up on something when they got close. But they did start. They started firing over our heads and then they started firing in front of us. Yeah.
So what did you do?
Look, I just kept walking, which sounds really noble, but it's not. I didn't know what to do. And I did feel that if I stopped, that it would mean an encounter. So I kept thinking, just ignore it. That's what I'd done so many times if I'd been around threatening people. I thought, if you just ignore it and keep on walking, just keep going.
What had they done with your guide, these bandits?
That was where the problem really started. He was screaming various things. And they pulled him over and they just started to hit him. And that absolutely unnerved me because there was something so mindless about the violence that they didn't think about it at all. Just reached out and clobbered him. And at that point, I came to a halt. And I have to stress at this point that some of the things my guide was saying were along the lines of, why don't you just take her? Leave me alone. I'm one of you. So I wasn't feeling overly protective toward him at the time, despite the fact he was being beaten. What they would have done to me was far worse than what they were doing to him. And it ended up in, I gave over some money and they toyed with us for a little while. They drove around and kept shooting. But I actually got the camels up and started walking again, not with their permission.
And they got bored?
They did. They drove around, they kept doing circles around and shooting, but in the end they drove away and I just kept on walking.
Paula continued walking into Niger and it was there that she fell ill. By then, she'd walked over 4,200 kilometres. She was more than halfway there. But she was arrested in Niger while she was sick, and she was ordered to leave the country by an official. An official who, it turned out, had heard of Australia's border control policies by watching Al Jazeera. The ongoing civil war in Niger means that Paula's not sure if she'll pick up the journey at all, and when we last spoke with her, she was planning another long walk through Australia. Paula Constant's book on her Sahara adventure is simply called Sahara. You're listening to a special edition of Conversations. These are all stories from guests who've been on the program, who have all, for one reason or another, decided to take the long walk. The long walk doesn't need to be an epic production. Hannah Gadsby is a comedian who had some time to spare. She was in England. She'd been feeling a little depressed. And the idea of walking across England suddenly appealed to her. Hannah took a lot of people by surprise because, well, the comedian's lifestyle of sleeping in and staying up late drinking was about as far as you can get from the life of your average long-distance athlete. So Hannah took her inspiration from a sheep farmer, the man who won the Sydney to Melbourne Ultra Marathon at the age of 61, Cliff Young.
Well, you know, Cliff was a shuffler. And as I was walking across England, I began to shuffle because I've discovered that I've got the body of a 61-year-old. Actually, probably worse.
And you're in 20-something?
No, 32.
32, okay. Right.
I'm too old to be young, but I'm not nearly old enough to be old.
Can I ask you why you decided to walk across England?
You can, but I can't answer it. It's, to this day, I don't know why. It was a very spur-of-the-moment thought I had. I saw a documentary on it, thought, I'll give that a crack.
Put down your beer and you said,
yeah, pretty.
I shall walk across England.
Bought a guidebook and some shoes. Totally unprepared.
From where to where?
It's up the north of England. It's a place called St. Bees to Robins Hood Bay.
Goes through, so you went from left to right rather than from up to down.
Oh, God, yes, it's not that far.
All right.
Yeah, it's pretty far for someone who's conditioned to sit on the couch.
Yeah.
It's 300-odd kilometres. 300. I made it 309. I made it 340 because, I got lost.
You got lost. So yeah. You don't know why you got the impetus to do this. You just felt you needed to go on a long walk.
Completely out of character. I'd gone over for the Kilkenny Comedy Festival, and then I had about a month or so to fill in. I was doing some gigs in London before I went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, but I was caught at a loose end, and I was coming off antidepressants because I'd forgotten to pack them. And I thought, you know what they say, walk it off.
And you did.
Yeah.
You did walk it off. You walked from, around the neck of England by the sound of things, essentially.
Oh, a bit lower.
A bit lower?
Yeah.
Okay, around the chest area of England.
It's hillier than you think.
Okay. And they've gained a great deal of satisfaction. Do you want to do it again?
Not that walk. England, it's a bit wet and miserable, to be honest. But I like the process of walking. I do. Like, it's that, I like knowing what I'm going to do every day. It's like set out. There's nothing, distracting you. You just got up, ate, walked, ate some more. The eating was great because you just
eat what you like.
Yeah. Well, not really. I put on weight. How's that? Yeah.
You put on weight while walking across the country?
Yeah. Well, it is, their national cuisine is based on the colour yellow. And that's not a cornerstone of a nutritious diet. And I was sort of discovering the joys of eating for fuel. And I might have, fueled with too many pork pies and things like that.
Hannah Gadsby wrote a show around her long walk experience that she called the Cliff Young Shuffle, and she performed it all over Australia. Gav Deer is a musician and a geologist, and Gav has been on many long walks. And one of his longest was through the Kimberley in northwest Australia. And this was not because he wanted to get the land into his system, but to get it out of it.
That landscape there, the Kimberley, had completely affected me. In the Kimberley, the landscape, it almost talks to you. The Kimberley is not a quiet landscape like Western Queensland is or those sort of places. The Kimberley, being water and stone, echoes, and it can just get inside you in terrible ways sometimes, and good ways too.
Gav had gone to live on El Cuestro Station in the Kimberley. It's a place of sandstone ranges and little rainforests and gorges and waterfalls. The station was set up originally, when Gav got there, as a kind of utopian commune. And then it fell apart, as utopian communes tend to do. So Gav stayed on as the caretaker in the wet season. But then the station was sold and the new owner wanted to develop it into a five-star resort. And Gav bitterly resented this, and he couldn't stop thinking about it.
This was my place now. This was the place that I had been looking for all these years. They were my waterfalls, and the spirit, I suppose, of that land had gotten inside me, which isn't really a good thing. Actually, there's a word for it. It's called topolepsy, where a geography, a topography, actually, it becomes too powerful inside you. And that's what happened to me anyway. All my dreams, it's like nightmares, dreams, everything. All my dreams, every second night, were on that landscape. You know, I just wanted to go back there and I wanted to burn that place down.
The guy who was redeveloping the area.
All I wanted to do was seek revenge. It was quite overpowering. And I was in, you know, you get sort of these lost moments in your life where you haven't got direction. And that's when I usually do these silly walks and stuff like that. You either get a job, you do a walk, or you lose yourself with your girlfriend. I think they're the three things that I end up doing. This one, I went back to the Kimberley. I knew nothing about it. The top end of the Chamberlain River, which is no access. No one had been in there for a long, long time, probably maybe 80, 100 years. Mate dropped me off in the Land Rover and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was just going to walk to El Questro, which is at the end of the head of the Chamberlain River. Didn't even know if I'd make it, really. It was just one of those things that if you just leave fate to do things, sometimes it works out. And it was such a hard trip. I had a dog with me. The dog died on the first day. It was so hot. Poor old dog just bloody went a bit haywire and found a scrub bull and went after a bull and got a kick in the head. So it was lonely from that first day, you know.
And what supplies did you have?
Oh, not much. I hate carrying weight. A fishing hand line, a bag of rice, two Orchi, big Orchi drink containers, one in each hand, 4-litre containers. Of course, I had to carry water. I never knew when the next water hole would be. And walked for 3 days. Geez, it was hot. That October in the Kimberley, there's nowhere in Australia like it at all. There's nowhere that approaches the humidity and close to 50 degrees centigrade. It cooks you. It fries you. 3 days I was walking. When you're doing like that, you're just thinking all the time. Your brain, walking just is like percussion, you know. It sort of lubricates the head, you know, and it just brings things out, circles them around until they pop out your ears or your eyes or something, these ideas. And after 3 days, I heard a dog bark. I saw in the bush there this fella, and there were two Vietnam veterans in there that had just sort of gone to die in there, basically. They'd left the world behind. These guys, Steve and Graham, hey, good day, mate. How you going?
This sounds like an hallucination.
The whole thing, when I look back, seemed like that, and some of these other walks did too. They said, how you going? Come in. And here, they had old army rations, powdered vitamin, you know, whatever they are, things that you add water to. And I had a meal with them. By the end of the night, we were all hugging each other, crying, you know, because these these guys, one of them would always lose the plot and the other guy would be there to nurse him back to health. And, you know, whenever they talked about their stories in Vietnam, one of them would always break down in tears. And it was a beautiful time. I spent 3 days camp with them, and they are great guys too. Like, they did the day before I got there, a crocodile had jumped into their little raft, and because they were trying to get the dog out. And so he said, hey, check this out, Gav. And he had this big stick and he'd written on it the crocodile be good stick. And so they used to walk along the riverbanks, each with the crocodile be good stick, just ready to wallop them, you know, if they launched out of the river at them. So that was a really sort of healing moment for me too, you know, seeing these two guys out there. They were there to die, you know, together. It's just a lovely thing, which they subsequently didn't. One of them got sick and his mate sort of dragged him back out and it took him to hospital, and I think one of them died after that. So I don't think they ever went back into there after I left. So I kept walking and walking and walking, and about a week later, I came across a Rhodesian. They were actually Rhodesian family. It was Zimbabwean, they call it now. Farmers that had, you know, their land was taken from them in Zimbabwe. They'd bought the bottom of El Questro Station, which no one had ever been into. Completely inaccessible, no road access. They'd built an old little airstrip. They'd raised their family in there, and they'd tamed all those cattle. They'd brung all those wild cattle and scrub bulls out of the bush bit by bit, and they could you could walk through all the cattle there and touch them and ride on them even. By the time I got to El Cuestro, which a couple of weeks later, after all that walk, and I just didn't care about Will and his resort. And that's the thing you see with Aboriginal people too. They can look through a landscape and they won't see a building because they see something else there. And maybe after that and all that time there before, it didn't concern me so much that his big five-star resort were there and all my fish that I used to feed had been caught and eaten, and the place was crawling with thousands of people, you know, having their own little lovely little camping times and all that sort of stuff. It didn't really worry me. And the only thing that I did snap at was when I went to Emma Gorge, which I used to spend a lot of time. It's a very famous gorge now. And I was always barefoot. You know, I did all these walks barefoot. And they wouldn't let me go up to the gorge because I didn't have shoes on, which is the most ludicrous thing. You know, I just walked hundreds of bloody kilometres. They're saying, no, I'm sorry, sir, you cannot walk to Emma Gorge without any shoes on. So that helped anyway. And I haven't really had those dreams ever since.
Gav Deer now lives in Cooktown, and that's where I interviewed him 3 years ago. He plays there with his band, The Road Trippers, and if you're ever where they are, you should definitely go and see them.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today on Conversations, we're bringing you a collection of stories called The Long Walk, and these are stories from people who, for one reason or another, felt angry or dissatisfied about something in their lives, and they've decided to walk it off. This next story describes another journey through a different part of the Kimberley, from a guy called Will Chaffee. These days, Will is a family guy. He lives in California. He works for Apple Computer. He's got a wife and kids. But about a decade ago, Will was a younger man, and he was feeling a little depressed and at a loose end.
Well, I just had a really bad senior year in high school. I'd fallen off a bike and injured myself and had a concussion. So I think they relate that to depression now. So I sort of went into a depression. It was midwinter, you know, the sun just sinking lower and lower and lower. So I just wanted to get to the warmth and just get away from my own culture for a while. I didn't have any real plan, just to get to Australia, take it from there.
So Will got on a plane and he came to Northern Australia. Will travelled throughout Queensland and WA, and eventually he met up with a guy called Jeff, who was a herpetologist, which is a fancy word for a snake scientist.
Jeff, he really is a wanderer. He's sort of a modern-day swaggy. He'd had some incident in his past that I never found out exactly what had happened, but at some point he had to just go to Australia. And at first everyone was quite scared of him. He just seemed a little menacing.
He said he was Canadian, and his name was Jeff, but he turned out he wasn't actually Canadian or Jeff, was he?
Right. Well, actually, I just discovered recently he has a British passport.
Oh, right.
So, but he speaks with an American accent, but he just loves Australian wildlife and reptiles.
Jeff, the herpetologist, told Will about a rare snake he wanted to find in the Kimberley, the rough-scaled python.
It was at the time, and probably still is, actually, Australia's rarest python. It was originally collected in the 80s, and they put it in a museum drawer. They thought it was a carpet python, and then somebody re-examined it and realized that actually it was a new species and possibly even a new genus of python, which is a pretty big deal.
Now, the guys realized that to take a picture of the rough-scaled python, they'd have to go into its natural habitat in the Kimberley. So they set out a bold plan to trek along the entire length of the remote Prince Regent River, one of the grandest and loneliest places in the world, in a landscape that's from the dinosaur age.
Well, it is. I think it is the Devonian coast. It's a very remote and ancient part of the world and very quiet. And the stars are absolutely brilliant.
Will and Jeff applied for and got some funding from Australian Geographic magazine, and they were off.
We hitchhiked to Wyndham, and then we got on a mail plane and flew to the Drysdale River Station. And then we just went to the Drysdale River crossing and started walking. We kept walking along the Drysdale for a couple of weeks, and then one of the most difficult things initially was trying to actually get into the Prince Regent River, because the canyon was cut so steeply that when we first got there, you know, we're trying to follow creeks down into the river, you'd come to a cliff, you know, you'd come to a big waterfall flowing in. So it actually took us a couple of days to actually get into the canyon, the main canyon.
It's what, 50 degree heat?
Very hot, lots of biting green ants, going through spider webs, and you know, you're very close to nature, but we didn't have a tent.
And you're saying, this is great, I'm having a great time.
Actually, you know, interestingly enough, for the first 40 days, it was a great adventure. I did almost set myself on fire at one point.
How did you do that?
Well, we'd been hiking for days and days, and it had just been raining, and of course it's so hot. But I just wanted to have a fire. I got this tinder together, and it sort of went, the flame went up a little bit and then went out, and I thought, oh, I'll just get my fuel out of my camping stove that we have. I'll just put a little fuel on there. But the problem was that I was just so tired and just so exhausted that I wasn't thinking clearly, and I actually held the lighter out and then poured the fuel right onto the lighter as it was lit. And of course the flames just leapt up into the bottle, you know, just went straight up into the bottle.
Boom.
And the bottle, you know, it was like holding a Roman candle. I'm sitting there and I'm all, you know, and of course it had been pitch dark, you know, when I was doing this, and then all of a sudden everything was brightly lit up, and Jeff's in the back of the cave, you know, sort of two eyes looking at me going, you know, what are you doing, you know? And so I knew the bottle wouldn't explode. I wanted to get rid of it. So I sort of turned around and threw it off the face of the cave there. And then I actually fell off the cave myself, but didn't land in the flames. But it was just...
Was your hand on fire?
And my hand was on fire. Yeah, I put that out. That's when I realized the one most dangerous thing about being out in the bush like this is if you're
tired,
you'll make bad decisions. We found this incredible gallery of paintings and also mortal remains. Skulls and, yeah, bound in bark.
Should you have been there?
Well, we didn't. You know, we actually erased our footprints in the sand when we left. And also you get the sense, you know, after being out in the bush for about 32 days or thereabouts, you do sort of pick up a sixth sense. We just had the feeling we were being watched. So we erased our footprints and then we decided to hike up as far as we could out of the canyon.
You probably were being watched, that's the thing.
Well, we were being watched. So that night as we were drifting off to sleep, we heard a dingo howl, but we both thought, that sounded a little strange. It didn't quite sound like a dingo howl that we'd heard before. And then we heard the click, 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 click sound of the Aboriginals striking the sticks together. Then we pretty much sat bolt upright, and, you know, I said to Jeff, what should we do? What can we do? He said, well, whatever they want to do to us out here, they can do. I mean, there's nothing we can, you know, we can't really. But we decided that we'd shown enough respect to the gallery, and also there were some pools, the so-called Ungud waters, that are the source of child spirits. And I'd actually gone to go for a swim, and then just for that reason of feeling like I was being watched, decided, no, I'm not going to swim in this pool. I'm going to go further up. So we hoped that we'd shown enough respect.
Did they make any contact at all?
We heard these amazing sounds, like a bird caught in a spider web, just these flapping sounds. And we heard the sound, which we, at the time I didn't know what it was. We thought they were throwing a boomerang over our heads from one side of the canyon to the other.
What's like a
yeah, that sound. And it was just amazing. Of course, we found out it's a bull roarer. It's something they use to fend off, you know, evil spirits. So, you know, we probably were trespassing, and they were trying to see us on our way. I really wished I'd been able to catch a glimpse of them, but I never saw them. In fact, one of the nights I climbed as quietly as I could, sort of away from our camp, and just sort of waited, and I could hear them making these sounds. They were completely invisible.
After a few weeks clambering along the rocky gorges of the Prince Regent River, away from all the clocks and the TVs and from the buzz and clutter of human activity, Will found that his grasp of time and space seemed to slip around a bit.
I mean, I think your mind just expands to fill that space. You know, I'm not a religious person in any organized sense, but it was a very spiritual experience to really feel like you were almost anywhere in time. There were these eternal experiences of just hearing the sound of the rain at night that, you know, is a sound that's been happening for millennia. Just watching the sunrise or the moonrise or the moon set, your clock just changes.
Were you remembering all sorts of things?
You do have a lot of time to process. You know, I did have time to look back on my life up to that point. But after about 35 or 40 days, really all you can start thinking about is food.
Getting back and eating. But there'd be times when at night, when there's cloud cover, and you live in a state of perfect darkness, where darkness is almost visible or present or something, or crowds in around you. Tell me about that feeling.
Well, actually, at one point, it was pitch dark. I was camped on a boulder. And I just woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, you know, where am I? Where am I? I had no idea. I didn't know if I was dreaming. I sort of put my hand in front of my face, right up to my eyes. I couldn't see my hand. It was just so dark. And then I realized, oh, you know, I'm camped on a boulder in the middle of the Kimberley and, you know, we haven't eaten for a couple of days and we need to get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, you could have been somewhere in deep space.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, even now, sometimes I wake up and pinch myself that I'm not out there on that broad eucalypt plain. Sometimes I keep thinking I'll still wake up and be starving, you know, but it hasn't happened.
Well, weeks went by as Will and Jeff walked along this incredibly beautiful and remote gorge, getting closer to the sea all the time. The only thing was they were starting to get seriously hungry. At last, the end came in sight, which was King's Cascade, this huge stepped waterfall where the Prince Regent River flows into the sea. They were hoping and expecting there would be tourist yachts there to take them back home. But it's hard to know how realistic this hope was because, well, this was the middle of nowhere.
We get into the valley of the Crystal Creek, and then suddenly we're standing at the top of the King Cascade looking out over this inlet. You know, in my mind, I just thought there'd be a regatta at the base. I mean, I thought there'd be boats and, you know, people sharing champagne and, you know, stuff like that. And of course, it was like any other waterfall in the middle of the wilderness. I mean, there was no one there. There was no sign of any human beings.
Did you have any food left?
We had a few days' worth of food left, yeah. But then as we waited at the King Cascade, we ran out of food.
How are you getting on with Jeff?
I was ready to see another person's face. Besides Jeff. We did get along quite well. We did have one incident where we almost killed each other, probably. Well, he broke my fishing rod. He wasn't much of a fisherman. Inadvertently, I mean, it wasn't his fault because I didn't have any oil to lubricate the reel. And there was actually a giant yellowfin tuna in the base of the lagoon. It took the bait, but then the reel jammed and the fish, you know, was able to get off. But at the same time, it was still stuck inside at the low tide. So I came down the face of the cascade, and I saw my reel in pieces, and there's this huge fish out in the inlet, which I contemplated running out and grabbing. But, of course, you sink up to your neck in the mud just about, so it wouldn't really be worth it. So I said to Jeff, you know, what did you do to my fishing rod? And he said, darn fishing rod, it didn't work. And now, you know, and I said, well, we need that fishing rod. And then we sort of squared off. We're sort of standing toe-to-toe, eye-to-eye, you know, on the face of this slippery waterfall with crocodiles in the water below, and you know, I just said, oh, well, I'm going to go up and have a cup of tea. And
So there you are. You've got no food left.
No radio.
No radio.
No GPS.
What are you going to do?
Well, so we had to figure out if we were going to stay at the King Cascade and just keep fishing. But, you know, fish, there's not enough carbohydrates. I mean, you really need rice. So after a while, you just don't have the strength to fish anymore. I could see the veins in my arms. I mean, I was really, really thin. So the option was to either wait at the King Cascade or to head out overland to the Mount Elizabeth Station.
How far away was that?
As the crow flies, I'm not sure, but our route was about 250 kilometers. It was a long, long walk.
And you're going to walk that without food?
Right. You know, we did have bush tucker, like we had figs that we could eat, but there wasn't a whole lot of that. Bush figs, what else? I mean, I ate a couple of grasshoppers, but I gave up. They were too bitter and, you know, didn't taste very good.
Man, you're a long way from that New England boy who got on a plane to Australia at this point, Will, aren't you?
Well, you know, that was the funny thing, too, was really how easy it was to live out there. With the exception of the lack of food, I didn't really miss anything else. There was plenty to see. There was plenty to do. There was always wildlife. You know, I didn't say, oh, gee, I wonder what's on telly.
I'm missing CSI Miami right now. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That didn't ever really come up.
That didn't never really popped into my mind.
The thing we missed the most, or at least what I missed the most, was a hot shower. And Jeff, I think the thing he missed the most was a cold beer.
So you made your way eventually to the station somehow.
Yeah. We, on our map, we had a little thin line, a little vehicle track saying, you know, Mount Elizabeth Station, And I think it said 70 kilometers this direction, but actually it was wrong. And it's a very rough track. I mean, we would actually be walking along it and we'd lose the track. It would just disappear. We kept going and going and going, and we got to the old homestead, which was deserted. And there's an old car parked at the old homestead, and I just thought, gosh, you know, am I a good enough mechanic that I could get this thing going, you know, but not a chance, you know.
And when you got there?
One of the Aboriginals who was there, you know, one of the stockmen, sort of took one look at me and said, you know, you need some meat, mate. Your ribs are sticking out.
And now you live in California. You work with Apple, as I said. You've got wife and kids.
Mm-hmm.
Do they know this story?
Actually, the girls and their cousins love to hear these stories. I told them the story about being at the King Cascade and fishing and having the crocodile come in. And
do you look back at that young man and go, wow, who was that young guy anyway that did that trip?
It almost seemed like that was the way things were supposed to happen. I mean, you know, it's a strange thing to meet a wanderer like Jeff and not really have any real plan. You know, but that's where the adventure starts, is, you know, when the money runs out, when the Jeep breaks down, that's when it gets interesting.
The final long walk we're bringing you today on Conversations is a pilgrimage. And if there's one thing a pilgrim needs before he starts the long walk, it's a staff.
My wife and I cut a wooden staff from a fruit tree in our garden, and we polished it, we put a leather strap on it, we put a metal ring at the bottom to protect it, and it became my companion on the journey. I wanted to do the full medieval bit with the sort of staff that St. James, Santiago, might have carried himself.
That's Tony Kevin. He's a retired diplomat who lives in Canberra. In the early 2000s, Tony had clashed with the then government over their border control policy. And by 2006, Tony was feeling a little burnt out and saddened by the whole experience.
I'd come out of a period of fairly intense political activism in Australia. I felt a little bit burnt out. I felt a little bit angry, perhaps even embittered. I found that the normal remedies, you know, taking long walks, spending more time with the family, gardening and so on, none of them were enough to really break the circuit of the mood of bitterness and alienation, I suppose, I'd got into. And I felt I needed something really dramatic and different to break out of it. And I heard about the pilgrimage to Santiago, and when I came into a little bit of money from a book price, my wife said, yes, by all means, spend some time on this walk. It might do you good.
The pilgrimage that Tony had his heart set on was to walk the Camino, to follow one of the old, old medieval roads that pilgrims have taken for centuries, from the bottom of Spain all the way up to the top of Spain, to the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela. Now, most pilgrims these days take the route from France, but Tony decided he'd take the route from Andalusia because it would be less crowded and hotter and drier.
I guess I wanted it to be difficult, and I chose the longest route I could find, which
why,
was...
Why difficult? Why difficult?
I guess I wanted to work out my issues, and I wanted a really challenging walk to do that. I suppose, Richard, I was looking for a couple of things. I was looking for a fair amount of solitude. I didn't much fancy the idea of walking on a trail with hundreds of other people.
Well, how many people are doing this pilgrimage?
About 100,000 a year arrive in Santiago. The blisters were really quite horrendous at the beginning, and within the first two and a half weeks, my feet were just basically two peeling raw strips. You really have to nourish your feet and revere them, because they're the most important part of making a pilgrim walk a success.
Would you start walking before daylight?
Start walking at first light. You'd normally go out the night before and reconnoitre the path out of the village so that you wouldn't get lost getting out of the village. And you'd start at literally the first glimmerings of light, which is normally about half an hour before the sun comes up. And you'd take full advantage of those early cool hours. I'd normally walk between 6 and 8, sometimes 9 hours a day, and try to be where I was aiming for by about 1 or 2 in the afternoon, find a place to stay, maybe have a little siesta, go out walking. Of course, walking around May, June, July, the days are the longest. You have about 15 hours of daylight, so there's plenty of time to actually experience the village in the afternoon and in the early evening.
What does a good staff do for you?
Most importantly, it helps to balance your weight. It also helps propel you along as a kind of a third leg. It also gets you across creeks and boggy ground. It becomes a friend, even though it's just an inanimate piece of wood. It was probably the closest companion I had on those 1,200 kilometres I walked.
Your walking days then fell into a rather lovely rhythm.
Yeah, well, once I'd got into the rhythm of it and once I'd got over the blisters, it became quite lovely because time stretched out enormously and the only thing that mattered was today, and yesterday was a distant memory and tomorrow was a long way away. And you have this lovely sense of, I called it riding on Shank's pony, where after a while your body becomes like the horse under you that just basically automatically does what's required of it. And you just basically let it alone. You don't stress it, you don't make demands of it, you just let it take control. And meanwhile, your mind ranges very freely over your whole life, and indeed over whatever you want to think about. You can come up with doggerel verses, you can sing, you can make up languages, you can do anything because you're completely on your own, very often, and in this immensity of landscape. And it's just a beautiful, different way to live for a while. It was a very simple life. It was like going out and working in the fields for several hours a day and then coming home and having complete relaxation. So in one sense, it's like being a manual worker, I suppose. When we're brain workers, we tend to carry our worries home with us, and they never really leave us, even in sleep. But with this pilgrim walking, you are somehow enormously simplifying things, and I think that's what's so refreshing to the spirit. A good friend of mine, Father Frank Brennan, compared it to taking your life for a walk, and I think that's a pretty good metaphor. You do fall into a heightened emotional state, and tears come very easily, and feelings of exaltation, feelings of joy, feelings of grief, they all are sort of much more raw and much more vivid than in normal life when things are sort of dulled over in the routine of daily life.
All these thoughts and memories came back to you. Do you think you were able to let that bitterness that you said you'd felt just start to seep away?
Yes. It was like lancing a boil. It just seeped away. I found myself feeling much more charitable towards people and events.
Why?
Than I had been.
Why?
I don't know. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. There's a sort of a grace in being able to be passionate without being bitter and angry.
Did you begin to dread the end of the pilgrimage?
Yes, I began to dread it, and as I said, the emotions as I approached Santiago became more and more volatile, and I perhaps became a little mad in the final days. I don't know.
A little mad? Why?
Perhaps a little manic depressive. I mean, there were moments of huge gloom, and there were moments of huge joy.
The end of your pilgrimage in the north of Spain. Tell me how you saw it. How did it come into view?
It came into view like Camelot. I came over a ridge after a last day of endless ups and downs, and I finally came over a ridge and looked across a valley, and there were these beautiful spires of the cathedral and the surrounding ecclesiastical buildings, and it looked and it felt like Camelot. It was just an amazing feeling. And there was this indescribable welter of emotions that, you know, flashed through my brain and through my soul, of achievement, of delight, of exultation, of sadness, of pain, everything. And then I walked on into the city, and it was all very quiet because it was a siesta hour. It was about 2:30 in the afternoon, baking hot day. It was very, very quiet. And I walked through the walls into the old city surrounding the cathedral. And then suddenly I came into a square called the Plaza de Cervantes, and I saw these hundreds of people streaming in from an alley coming in from the right. And these were all the pilgrims arriving on the Camino Frances in all their great human variety. And I joined the stream rather mechanically, and we just followed the final kilometre towards the cathedral. I found this grotty pension for about 20 euros a night. Still felt pretty gloomy. Thought, oh, gee, what a sense of anticlimax. But then the next morning, I went back to the cathedral for the mass at 11 o'clock. I'd had a good night's sleep and, you know, my emotions had calmed down a bit. And it was just so exciting. There were thousands of people in the church, one of these huge Spanish Gothic cathedrals, about 15 priests in red and white vestments for the high masses. Every day's a high mass. This great brass censer, this incense burner that weighs about 80 kilograms, that hangs on a huge chain, and they start swinging it on a pendulum, and it gradually describes these huge arcs up and down the main nave of the church, puffing out this incense. And of course, the reason for that was that pilgrims in medieval times used to arrive so smelly that basically the whole church needed to be fumigated. So then, instead of a homily, the priest went up into the pulpit and simply thanked all of us pilgrims for our tremendous sacrifice. And that's this religious theme of the pilgrimage, that the pilgrim is actually experiencing great hardship and privation for the sake of God and for the sake of his fellow men and women.
But do you deserve, you know, this Tony, do you deserve thanks, though? I mean, you're not doing it for other people. You're doing it for yourself, aren't you?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I felt that I was doing it to help me, but the general theology of pilgrimage is that you are doing it not only to help yourself, but as an example, if you like, and as an inspiration to others, and as a reaffirmation of the sense of human community under God. So the priest up in the pulpit was actually reading out the lists of who had come from where. So, you know, several hundred people on the Camino Frances from France, several hundred from Germany, several hundred from Netherlands, and one pilgrim on the Via de la Plata and Via Mozarab from Granada. And that was me. I was so excited. I felt like a kid at school going up for the prize, you know, and I nudged the people alongside me and I said, that was me, that was me. I guess there's something about pilgrimage, Richard, that takes you back to your childhood. It takes away a little bit of the irony. It restores to you the simple innocence of childhood.
It's your boyish enthusiasms.
Right. Absolutely, yeah.
Tony Kevin's book, Walking the Camino, was published in 2006.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.